Happy Pride Month from Real Poets. We are revisiting one of our early episodes, recorded before we found our rhythm behind the mic, but one whose conversation still means a great deal to us. In this episode, we explore Wilde, the story of Oscar Wilde, whose brilliance, wit, and courage continue to inspire generations. His life reminds us both the beauty of living authentically and the cost so many have paid simply to love openly. Join us as we celebrate Pride through the lens of poetry, film, and one of history's greatest literary voices. The Price of Want Denied. The love that's found between a youth and one with years collected well has coined gold lies embossed with truth. For moonlit passions time will quell. The merchants trained to cloak their wares, proudly displayed yet veiled from view, arrange their clients' doomed affairs through covenant sweetly renewed. A bargain struck without return, no patron leaves here satisfied, yet connoisseurs alone discern the value of a want denied.
Real Poets is an audio-only podcast that can also be visually read, like roses, or when a director juxtaposes his or her most imposing reposes with characters, settings, and themes, composed of thrilling soundscapes, highest of stakes, and dreams. Hosted by a duo of real poets about real poets and the real poetry they've written and the films that have been written about them and their work.
Join us each week as we talk to another real poet with something to say and how a real poetry movie influenced them in some way. Then we each write a new poem inspired by our most recent viewing of the film and share it with all of you. Welcome to Real Poets. I am Renzo del Castillo, always joined by my good friend.
Tis I, Scott Raven, with the three T's, here on the realest of the real, the real poets.
The real poets. You know, my friend just had a kid, and so she also has three T's. Yeah. So now whenever we call her T3.
But we're not talking about T3 today.
We're talking
about the Wilde with the E.
I, you know what, man? This is another movie that I wasn't too crazy about, except I really love the performances, and I'll tell you why. Stephen Fry to me is just I have all his Greek mythology books that he's put out. I have the audiobooks because I just love hearing his voice, his cadence. Very funny guy. You know, British comedian, been around a long time. People might know him from V for Vendetta as well. But Wilde came out in 1997, directed by Brian Gilbert. It starred Stephen Fry as Oscar Wilde. It was the debut of Jude Law as Lord Alfred Bosie Douglas. Jennifer Ely played Constance Lloyd, or Constance Wilde, also very famous for my favorite on-screen version of Pride and Prejudice, the BBC 1990s version miniseries. She played Elizabeth Bennet. Vanessa Redgrave, Max.
Classic.
Max in Mission Impossible 1. Vanessa Redgrave had a bigger career than that.
The acclaimed theater actress as well.
Yeah. And she played Lady Wilde, Oscar's mom. And we have the great Tom Wilkinson in the role of the Marquis. So,
yeah. And one more, we would say, and Michael Sheen as well.
Michael Sheen as Robbie
Robertson
Robbie Reed, also a poet. Yes, also a poet and a good friend of Oscar Wilde. So basically, this is actually a pretty straightforward film. It's a biographical drama tracing Wilde's life from his rise as a celebrated playwright and poet through his relationship, discovering he was homosexual after he was married, his relationship with Bosie, his trials for gross indecency, his imprisonment, his eventual exile. So that's the movie that we are discussing today.
Yes. I was also a little lukewarm with this, I will say. instead of Skywalker Hot or tell me why.
I'll tell you why after you tell me why. Why? What was missing for you?
Yeah, maybe from what we've been seeing, like you're saying, it was a little too straightforward. It just felt a little flat. Stylistically,
it was missing poetry for me.
Right. It was missing visual poetry, I would say.
Visual poetry. I mean, we had a lot of his epigraphs. We had a lot of his books, his witty sayings, but his poetry wasn't really there. And then when you read the poetry of, I believe Bozzi wasn't supposed to be really great at poetry. Like the poetry that you do hear falls a bit flat, right? It was more about living life poetically, but it again felt a little flat. I do want to state that I think the performances were, specifically Stephen Fry, I thought it was fantastic. Jennifer Ely she's always great. I don't think she had much of a role the way it was written.
In particular, the end scene. I mean, their prison scene is fantastic.
Yeah. Michael Sheen, I thought was really, really great too. Ian Griffith also, one of the OG Mr. Fantastics, also played a poet and a lover of Oscars as well.
Tom Wilkinson also wonderful as Bozzi's dad.
Yeah. The Marquis.
Great performance.
Marquis of something, but Lord Douglas as well.
Now let's say there is poetry from the opening scene is poetry.
I want to get into the relationship. Like I think we need to evaluate it as if we're relationship therapists or couples therapists or something, because
another reason I didn't like it too is just I don't know. I love his plays. I love them. I've acted in a few of them.
They're fantastic.
I've done scenes from them, and the wit stands the test of time. It's just these one-liners that can be applied to any relationships. I mean, any marriages, any relationships. So, any chance to maybe just hear one of them too, but they work best in the context of a play when you have these characters interacting with each other. And what's lost is they're aside from maybe the scene at the dinner with him and Bozzi's dad, that repartee with character. It's just kind of him in these areas where, he's a little morose, a little sad, when he's not getting to be that center of attention
they make reference, like the character of Constance makes reference that people don't understand how much Oscar needs an audience, but I didn't really see the hedonism that he is known for. I think was glossed over in the movie. We really saw him more as a piner, somebody who was waiting, like who was holding up that boombox for Bozzi, right? And they kept saying like he's never fallen in love. Like you loved Oscar, now he's fallen in love. And it's different, but I don't know if it's love, right? And that's a question I have for you. Is it love or is it obsession when it comes to Oscar and Bozzi?
I think Oscar loved him. I mean, from their first meeting, there was a kind of like pushback that he hadn't experienced before. He was visually very attracted to him instantly, but their first conversation for me felt to me a little bit of like, this was an intellectual attraction as well. And then even him doing something so wicked, Bozzi, on the other hand, I didn't think felt the same way.
No,
he outwardly says it.
Oh, I think that Oscar loved Bozzi. He didn't love himself, right?
Oscar did not love himself, you're saying?
he didn't love himself. Not when it came to Bozy, not when it came to self-respect, not when it came to setting boundaries, right? And I don't know if he loved Bozy or if he loved his youth. Dear boy, right? And in terms of Bozy, Bozy loved himself. And he loved Oscar. And there are scenes where Oscar says, he loves me as much as he can love somebody else. And oh my God, I've had so many friends who have said something similar. Like, look, he loves me as much as he can. She loves me as much as she can. And typically when that happens, they don't love you.
Yeah. I mean, he loved his children. And you have that nice framing, you know, device of him telling kind of this giant tale throughout the whole movie. And but I wonder why. Like, yeah, that didn't give him a degree of fulfillment. You know, I know it's not romantic, but it's just like that love. You see, he's expressing it to him, but perhaps he wasn't able to get it. It wasn't reciprocated in the way that he needs of like a. Like a counterpart.
Well, he tells us, I mean, in that scene you mentioned at the end when they're speaking in the prison, he tells his wife that he did love her. He doesn't say in my way. He says, I did love you. I just didn't know myself. I didn't know who I was. And after knowing who I was, if I had faked it, even more so than he already did in terms of keeping up appearances, it would just be dishonest. So I believe he was speaking in paradox. I'm like, you are being dishonest anyway. But
that's something I've been attracted to about the work always. You meant paradox of everything and the double meaning of one-liners.
Well, we keep talking about his one-liners. I wrote a couple down if you want me to go through them, some wild epigrams.
Yeah, so, no, I used to keep a list of them as well. That's something I was coming into contact with too. Like, I've always prided myself as being a wit, mm-hmm. right? And like, but I can't, if you were to ask me to just, all right, say a line of witty quotes, I wouldn't be able to do it. But if I'm in a situation and I can pull a reversal based on what I hear, I can come across witty. It's just something like, all right, yeah. But maybe there was a time when I was reading tons and doing that sort of stuff. And you know, when somebody says you've lost your wits, I haven't read a lot lately, just read. And that I feel fuels when you're just seeing words and being able to do that and that sort of thing. Real quick, before you read a couple of his, what was Oscar's, where did this come from? I mean, it's pushing against, you know, kind of the repressive environment with which he's in, reading, I guess, for him as well. He was at Trinity College, I believe.
Correct.
It's just, did it dip into where that came from at a young age for him?
I don't know. I mean, he is Irish, and the Irish have a long history of suffering. But he is privileged as well, right? And he has the benefit of going in, and he falls back into his old Irish accent, his old Irish brogue, for comedic effect within the movie. He has a very distinct diction. I think he's always just, I mean, he was a genius when it came to expressing himself and expressing ideas and communicating, which is why I think he was so successful with his plays. His poetry, I admire the man more than I admire his poetry. I'm not saying it's bad. It's just, I think his other works kind of eclipsed it. Right. But But I think he was intelligent. I think he knew he was intelligent, and I think he felt like he was always so happy when he found what he considered a peer. And then he had a mother who told him he was a genius. So he was nurtured, and he had every benefit in life that could be afforded at that time. The movie begins with his tour of America, where he's reading his poetry or his works to different host communities. And the beginning of it is a silver mining community where he was very, very fond of the bodies of the miners that he was, miners with an E, that he was observing and still being the life of the party. And we catch him right before he gets married, and he believes he's happy and he's having children until he meets Robbie and another world opens to him. So I think I don't really know how to.
Robbie feels guilt, feels some guilt, if it wasn't for that bringing that out of him, who knows?
Yeah, no,
He
but I
forgives
believe that
himself, though, I
the
believe.
Sphinx, right? His friend, the Sphinx, the character of his friends, I forget her name, but his nickname for her is the Sphinx.
The Sphinx,
And
yeah.
she tells Robbie when he feels guilty, no, imagine if it wasn't you, somebody else who would be less discreet or somebody who didn't
Believe
love
him.
him, right?
Right.
So there was that aspect to it. But when it comes to Wilde, like where did that develop? I think he was just always an intelligent person who lived among people he couldn't relate to. So he chose to be the most interesting one, right? When it comes to Wilde, I think the number one thing I remember in terms of his epigrams is I can resist everything except temptation, because it's so funny and it's so simple and it cuts directly to the heart of the matter, right? And he's calling to attention the hypocrisy that you can have. Like, I can resist everything except temptation. And who resists temptation? And as a matter of fact, I don't believe he wanted to either. Right. So that's the one that stays with me.
I keep going back to, that's why his plays are better. It's just when he has something to push against, when it is another character that he can kind of, all right, like pull a reversal on. Within a poem, if you're only with one speaker, sometimes that's hard to do. If it's a single speaker, and it's just kind of him just expounding a thought, they don't pop as much as, I mean, his novels and his plays. Yeah, his
We haven't
poetry.
even mentioned the Picture of Dorian Gray, which is
Oh, yeah.
fantastic,
Yeah. Right.
right?
Yeah. Incredible. I mean, how many incarnations of that have come of that? I was reading somewhere too, like during this time, the movie that this came out, his plays were more popular than ever. I mean,
And
he has such
I'm
a.
sorry, that's who Ian Gruffudd played. He played George, Lord John Grey, or John Grey, who seems to have inspired the
Oh, right.
picture of
That's good.
Dorian Gray.
Right. Oh, man.
Also a poet. Robbie, a poet. Bosie, a poet. And I think maybe that's to go back to what I was saying. The movie's populated with poets, but I feel there's so little poetry, or it doesn't dive into poetry because it is a biography. I'm not, holding it to unrealistic expectations, but I think there was some meat to it, and they might have avoided it the way they avoided his, as I mentioned, his more hedonistic tendencies that have been widely documented.
Right. I mean, it's exploring though his relationships. I mean, it's exploring his homosexuality primarily. I mean, that is such the focus of this. And I mean, the obscenity trial scene, is poetic in the way that it becomes like a play of him kind of, all right, I'm able to speak out against something and says that beautiful speech, yet he gets the harshest sentence that there is. I mean, that judge was not too kind.
No, but I mean, that whole trial was just the manifestation of Bosie's self-interest. He coerced Oscar to take his father to trial, knowing in order to punish his father for being unkind to him, knowing full well that he's not discreet. There were many witnesses to their activities that could come forward. And Oscar, feeling like he needed to protect Bosie, follows through against everyone's, Robbie's advice, other people's advice. And that sets him up for punishment, right? And like the speech that he had was beautiful, but it shows, I think, Oscar's lack of love for himself. He's like the unspoken love between an older gentleman and a younger companion. But again, it also goes to his fascination with staying young, staying vibrant, staying smart, like to stay away from decay, to stay away from decline, right? And he ends up in jail where he declined doing hard labor. I forgot who told him, like, I think his lawyer said, you know, men of our constitution wouldn't last more than 8 months, and this is 2 years of hard labor. And he ends up with meningitis, which ends up killing him eventually. And when Robbie is discussing this with Bosie, the conversation boils down to like, Oscar's mine and I will have him, right? It's not even like, I love him, I'm going to take, like he says, I'll take care of him. But it really is like, oh, I want, he's my property, I want him. But then when he asks him for water, it's like he has very violent outbursts. He's like, I don't like you when you're sick. You're not attractive to me when you're sick. I will give it this. I can't stand the character of Bosie. And then that means Jude Law did an excellent job. And no wonder he got so many more opportunities after this. But I was really more bothered by the character of Oscar, an imposing man, an intelligent man, a man of means, who was unable to stand up for himself with somebody like Bosie.
But that's maybe how it went down. I mean, but so are you placing that on actually Oscar Wilde? Yeah. I mean,
because, and this is for somebody who professes the love he professes for his children and his wife, they were the last people he was thinking about.
Yeah, they gave a list.
At least as portrayed in the movie. I want to state that before that, as portrayed in the movie, right? We're talking about the movie, not the actual events that happened.
Now, what's to be said for these great love poets that seem to write from a perspective of male and female? I mean, they mentioned three in the movie too. I mean, you had Oscar, you have Shakespeare. Who are the two other? Plato and...
Oh, in the trial scene.
Right, Plato, and then I think one more. And there's something to be said for, I don't know, there's still some, they're up for interpretation. Like Shakespeare, yeah. I mean, the young boy, then the dark woman. The question I'm just posing is, would a playwright and an author be able to write accurately of that type of affection without actually indulging in it? Like Shakespeare, possibly. I mean, who knows? You know, people have this idea of, oh, he's the guy that wrote Romeo and Juliet, you know, and...
So you're saying, do you write what you know?
Yeah, right? Do you write what you know? Because, I mean, I guess he's leaning in his speech. He's saying that a little bit, too, that there's an intellectual curiosity between, you know, between him and Bosey. Whether or not, like, that would seem like any jury could understand that aspect of connection between two people.
I don't think the problem was.
No, it's him and the
problem. They were doing. It's the way of how they went about it. And it's the way that, you know, he's this Irish immigrant in England who's rubbing their noses in the fact that they're not as intelligent as him. And there's also the aspect of society loves to build people up and then tear them down. I did see some of those themes resonating in this movie.
Yeah.
And when I think of the themes, you know, I found four things that I wrote down. Art versus morality, which is something that we've talked about in other movies. Love and destruction, which you were hinting at right now. Identity and exile is another theme that I saw running throughout this movie. And performance of self. So I want to... Actually, first, let me read a couple of those epigraphs.
Yeah, I have a couple up here as well.
And then I want to get into that because I have some questions for you. But you just asked the question about, you know, does he write what you know or how, where does he come from? And he had an epigraph for that. It was, no great artist ever sees things as they really are. If he did, he would cease to be an artist.
Right. Something I had read too, the importance of being earnest. Earnest meant gay back then as well, too, which I had no idea. Which just kind of the paradigm, like it's in the title. All right, let's hear a couple quotes, or we can alternate reading a couple.
Let's alternate. Give me one.
Always forgive your enemies. Nothing annoys them so much.
I love that. That's great. That's great. On Truth and Masks, man is least himself when he talks in his own person. Give him a mask and he will tell you the truth.
Yes. That was in the film as well.
Mm-hmm. The alcohol one is great too.
Oh, yeah. This one I resonate with a lot. I am so clever that sometimes I don't understand a single word of what I'm saying. The poet can get lost in the double and the triple meaning sometimes. Where,
oh my god, that one's great.
That's great.
I like to love oneself is the beginning of a lifelong romance.
Mm.
And again, like if he truly was that way with Bosey, I can see why he would write that. That's his ideal. Like I wish I could feel love all the time. I wish I could love myself, but I think he had an issue loving himself.
Right. This connects with that a little too. This is actually from Dorian Gray. The books that the world calls immoral are books that show the world its own shame.
Mirrors.
Mm.
Mirrors again.
Yeah, there's like the morality.
Morality, right? So every saint has a past, but every sinner has a future. And then I also have, we are all in the gutter, but some of us are looking at the stars, right? The importance of hoping. But
any idea of whether his kids got into the arts?
They did. They did. I did some research. I believe they were both authors, both writers. Yeah.
Oh, nice. Because I saw that he just had, after the wife passed, he had no connection to them. He was forbidden to actually see them.
He was forbidden from seeing them. And I think in real life, Constance wasn't letting him see them either.
So that seemed fabricated by the...
No, I think he violated the Bosey thing before she died. Sure. Like she... And so for our listeners... wherever you are out there. She, hello. she told him, like, on the condition you never see Bozy. And in the movie, he says, if I see Bozy now, I'd kill him. Right? Which to me was such bullshit when you find out he wrote De Profundis for Bozy right after, like, this massive letter saying how much he loves him, so I can't see you again. I'm like, okay, yeah. I'm sure you'll kill him. But, no, he never, I believe he never saw his children again.
My goodness.
He died in poverty in Paris. He had a saying too, like, Saint someone, like, I've also married poverty, but my marriage is not as successful as his was, or something like that. He had another joke. But let me go to
well,
another
state, okay. I was gonna
go ahead.
Question based on that.
No,
do you think in today it's that this type of, like, you know, like the double life that people end up having, it still happens today. It boggles the mind that,
yeah,
that, you know, I mean, I had a gay friend, still have a gay friend, that moved to Cali, and when, after he came out, he's like, yeah, I'm probably gonna marry a woman, and, you know, maybe have some kids, but then still have relationships on and off or whatever behind the scenes. That was when he first came out, I guess, as a teenager. And then now, you know, he's in his 40s, as am I, fully out and only, you know, dating men and that sort of thing. But I still believe there are people that don't even make that move. I guess if you're living certain places, that there is still that pressure to hide, or if you're from generationally certain families, that happens. I mean, arguably, people think that that's much of the Republican Party. This type of repression. But yeah, I mean, is that something for you easy to fathom that still exists so prominently?
Yeah, I believe so. As I mentioned before, I'm a recovering people pleaser. So there was a point in my life when a good friend of mine asked me what I liked, and I couldn't answer him because it was in relation to someone else. I didn't know what I liked, and I was living my life for others. And in doing so, that was veiled, that was duplicitous, because there was a life I was living, and there was a life I was repressing, and the life I was repressing was what I wanted, what I wanted to do, what I desired, which was different from what I was doing for a variety of reasons, right? I focused on financial safety, and I was leaving behind creative expression, and it wasn't working. It was a point where it comes to a head. And I think that's because A, I wanted to be safe, but B, it's also what I believe my family would expect from me at that point, right? So it is easy for me to fathom that people, I think we want to have it all, or to have as much as we can. And if we are true to certain aspects of ourselves, we alienate, or we reduce the choices that we have based on how society perceives us, right? So for example, if I decided to be a hippie poet in Cambridge instead of a successful healthcare executive, would my parents' sacrifice in coming and emigrating to this country when I was very young be validated, right? Like, there's little things like that that you have to think about. So, and then, once my parents also went through their journeys and they realized they just wanted to see their son happy, right? Like, it's an interesting thing, but you know, like, I'm straight, I'm heterosexual, so I can only sympathize with my friends who are gay. I can't empathize. But
Right. I mean,
they've confided in me, and it's there's so many complexities to, you think, I assumed when I was younger, like, okay, you're gay, so you deal with things, but I didn't know there were levels of like, what is it to be an Afro-Cuban bottom in the dating scene in New York as opposed to a white top? You know what I mean? Like, there's different like spheres of there's a different hierarchy and what options are available to you as you date, or like it was surprising to me because I thought if you were marginalized, I assumed in the past, I don't assume this now, that if you were marginalized, you wouldn't marginalize others.
Yeah.
And I've been very surprised.
Oh
I
yeah.
mean,
I mean, I keep thinking about Hollywood, especially. I mean, that's where that re not repression, but I mean, actors in particular keep it hidden for so long, and it comes out repressively in other because how it will affect their career, so that they wouldn't be. It's so weird. Like
like
they want
Rock
to live
Hudson.
the. They want to live the work life that they want to be able to live, and that work life is they playing characters that are outside of just being a gay or gay male. Yet they're hiding that aspect of them, and then you see, the leading man will end up coming out, and I guess. Yeah, they don't want to be pigeonholed. Now it's flattening a little bit. But yeah, you make a point. The point that I keep coming back to that you were making is like, yeah, when you took control of your life, of like, all right, this is what I want to do. You were always aware though that there were, all right, if I want, that is out there. There are some people, I guess, in rural areas that maybe they're so still so sheltered, or insulated from. Oh, I can't even believe that this is even out there for me to live. But there are so many now places that are I feel tolerant and inclusive for people to live that life that they want to live.
I think it just I don't mean to simplify it, but I feel, at least for me, truly accepting oneself, truly accepting what about you differs from the norm, gives you the ability to have courage and live the life that you want, or for the most part, which could come into conflict, but you have the fortitude to live through that, right? You are clear on what you want. Like in this movie, Oscar wanted Bozy, but he also wanted to have his wife and children on the side. He wanted to have his success. He wanted to have his friendships with other men. I mean, the movie makes it seem like Oscar wanted to be monogamous, but in order to keep Bozy, he'd accept, watching him sleep with other men. But again, if you read the historical Wild, it seemed Wild was a more active participant in different activities. So I do think it comes from like if you know yourself, if you accept yourself, then you're able to stand up for yourself.
Right. Yeah. When you can, and yeah, take control of your life. Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Find what you need.
Well,
I was in Jamaica. Twenty years ago, and I was at this like couples retreat resort, and one of the servers was this Jamaican black guy that you could tell he just wanted to be like a dancer, and
impressive, background. And he, you know, would dance. He was a bartender, but then he was also part of like the entertainment committee that was there on the resort. And we came and I ended up doing a poem. And then a woman that I was with at the time said that, oh, we live in New York and she does, you know, fitness and all this stuff. A year after we left, he moved, picked up everything. He moved to New York, started working at Equinox, and then lived the most fabulous gay life that he could ever dream of.
As he often should.
Yep. It was wonderful. Where he didn't know he could do it, and then he was able. He just was like, "All right, I'm leaving this thing behind." Nice little tale.
But so let's talk about that for a bit, right? Like, because I think that comes into identity and exile, right? Like what I mentioned. So wild sexuality and his eventual refusal to conform to societal hypocrisy lead to his public ruin. Mm-hmm. And exile becomes both physical and emotional. He's separated from his family, from his friends, and from his adopted homeland at the end, right? But I don't know if he... Like, should art be judged? Like, because his wit and his literary genius, they collided with that strict moral code. And again, there's a lot of hypocrisy there, right? In terms of what we saw from the people upholding the moral code of Victorian society. The question I think the movie's asking is, should art be judged separately from the artist's life? But I disagree with that in the sense that Wilde's art was fed and was a direct result of his life. So why make that distinction, right? This is not, oh, I want to listen to an R. Kelly song. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like, oh, I work out to victory and now I can because of, it's not that question. The question is like, Oscar Wilde was actually, he was pardoned, I think, in the 19th century, in the 20th century, right? He was one of a group of people that the United Kingdom pardoned for those crimes that he was convicted of. But if he wasn't himself, I don't know if he would have written what he wrote. I don't know if Lady Wintermere's Fan would come out. I don't know if The Importance of Being Earnest would have come out. I don't know if Dorian Gray would have come out if it hadn't been informed by his life. So why would you judge it separately? Why would you judge it? You know, I don't know where morality plays a part there. What do you think?
No, I agree with you on this.
But only on this.
Only this, nothing else. Yeah.
All right. So would you call the relationship with Bozy toxic?
Meeting the in-laws or meeting the father and then leads to destruction. Yeah, but toxic and just...
Oh, I think he's a walking red flag, right? But it doesn't mean it's not passionate.
Yeah, you would think that, though, that he would be able to learn from that. He, you know, just hypnotized. I mean, like, it was some of the cruelty, though, that he was attracted to. Yeah, I mean, because the Michael Sheen character, yeah, I mean, that was a working still friendship. And,
yeah, it's funny. I thought I would find myself rooting for Michael Sheen and Oscar Wilde to make it work because it seems like there was a genuine love and affection there. An affection, at least.
Right.
But then
right.
I was like, I don't root for this. Like, cheated on, like, you're there, like, cheating with on the wife, and you're looking at her and saying, oh, I love you so. Like, the hypocrisy there is great too, right? Especially, like, when she is kind to them. So I can't say that I found myself rooting for it to work, but I think he would have been a better, a kinder partner than Bozy.
Exactly. Yeah. Or some, yeah, something that, all right, he could have maybe had a stable relationship. Well, yeah.
He understood Oscar. That's the other thing. They understood each other. But I don't know. It seemed like love can inspire genius, but it could also hasten a downfall. And it definitely hastened Oscar's downfall.
Do we talk about prison? We talked a little bit about it, but yeah. What do you think? You cut out for prison?
I actually think the prison was a parallel to his relationship with Bozy. And I mean, he was in prison outside of prison. He was in prison inside.
Right. But like the view of prison too, though, is like, all right, don't drop the soap. It, like, as in a place where that there is homosexuality rampant, but this was a clear distinction that it's like, all right, this is a work prison that is going to break your back. And, you know, I just like not that type of, like, it seemed like, yeah, the sign of the times where, I mean, just people shouting pervert at him as he's leaving the trial.
In his face. Right.
Right. So the prison wasn't as welcoming either.
Actually, I thought it was fascinating that when he left prison, he was shaking hands with everybody. Everybody seemed to have affection for him when he left, as opposed to being like, you degenerate, you this. I mean, when he left prison, he's like, well, goodbye by name, Yeah, they were all exactly. Like very kind to each other. Like, he has a knack for being well liked.
Right. But I guess maybe emotionally, physically.
I'm not saying that they didn't break his back. I'm not saying that prison was a fun time. I'm just saying
but he still charmed them. Yeah.
He still charmed them. Exactly. Because there is a version of the story where they would be like, get out of here, you pervert.
Right.
It's that pervert, isn't it? You know, like, but that's not what we got. It's he commanded respect. He commanded admiration. It's interesting. I mean, that's what I took away from it. Like, even as he was clearly going to be imprisoned and on trial, and he's answering as honestly as he allowed himself to be, people still clap for him.
Yeah.
They clap for him just as much as they spit in his face. Let me ask you a couple of questions and then we can just wrap up and read some poems. But what parallel, I mean, we've talked about it, but let's be more explicit. What parallels do you think can be drawn between Wilde's persecution and contemporary debates about identity, sexuality, and censorship?
Oh, yes. The current administration, the administration that is going
so
on.
So Jack Black of you, the administration.
The administration, I think. I mean, rights being stripped and just. It, like, not even want to hear from the other side, like, you know, I mean, yeah, like, that judge was the most impenetrable man, just such a beast. I mean, you know, and you even see the Tom Wilkinson character, and I guess, yeah, that is the people that still exist like that.
Yeah. You know, You know, I'm a James Bond fan, and my friends and I, whenever we watch a Bond movie together, we play a game. We vote on which character was the most British person in the movie. I thought it was Tom Wilkinson, but I believe the judge is the most British person in the movie. Ah, the most severe
Amazing.
punishment I could ever think. Like it was intense. But I don't know. Like today, I mean, we have cancel culture exists. Some deserve it, maybe, some doesn't. It doesn't, I've seen Denzel Washington talk about, like, what does it mean to be canceled? By who? If you're not participating, who's gonna cancel you, right? But I do think that Wilde's persecution and our debates nowadays in terms of like identity, sexuality, and censorship, I don't know if much has changed. You're still judged on the court of public opinion.
But
And
him specifically, Wilde, he wouldn't be canceled. I mean, like you said, he had part. I mean, is there other dirt on Wilde too that is up for debate and is controversial? What's coming to mind for me is Pee-wee as himself. Did you end up watching that? The Pee-wee Herman, Paul Rubens documentary?
I started it. I started it because, oh God, David Arquette was promoting it, because David Arquette is a friend of Paul
He
Rubens.
sticks up for
Yeah,
him.
so he I watch a lot of wrestling. He was on Chris Jericho's podcast with RJ City, who is another former wrestler, and they were both friends with Paul Rubin, and they were talking about it. So I started watching it, but I didn't finish it.
Oh, well,
It's not
the
bad.
core,
It's
I
good,
love
but
it. I love it. The core of it that parallels this somewhat is, he's brought up on obscenity charges. If you remember Paul
oh yeah,
Rubens,
I just caught masturbating,
caught masturbating in a theater, and then there was another thing that also came out that, like he had an old comic book that had an image of, a younger boy within it of some sort, but it was not anything sexual. And like there's a legit part of the movie where he is, yes, I might have hid my homosexuality for a period of time, but I am now happily, openly gay, and I am not a pedophile. I am not a pedophile, and that idea of something like that, reviles me, and all that, and convincingly and emotionally portrays that truth, but unfortunately, some of society still viewed him as.
I don't even think it's some. I think society, a lot of the arguments for not allowing gay couples to adopt is that they are pedophiles, which, what the hell, right? Like you're making this correlation, but that's something that is out there as a debate and
Is
as a
still there.
reason to prevent a loving couple from adopting children, in my opinion, right? I don't know if much has changed, right? Like I still think that they tie true depravities with people who are different. And it's just like, well, you're different, then you're also this, then you're into bestiality, then you're a pedophile, then you're this, then you're that, right? And then I don't know if much has changed, honestly.
What has changed is there are more places that are safe havens and safe spaces for people to live their true life. There are more spaces to do it, I think. You have to do you have to seek it out. It's unfortunate that it's not globally free. There are more places, though, and more communities and more environments with which things are accepted, that there is that is acceptance. Like there's that there's an interesting theme we didn't talk a little bit to, like he's Bosie's a bit of a fame whore too,
Yeah.
where and
He's the worst,
may
man. I'm saying it right
right
now. Bosie's the worst.
yeah
And maybe within that, but you can live a quiet, private life safely with a maybe relatively obscure small community the way you want to live. More readily in this world, I think. There's certain spots. There's tremendous hatred and oppression in a lot of other areas, but would you argue there are more spots with which you can? Or no?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, is there something to be said that you should be able to live out and about?
Yeah,
anywhere. I don't want to live.
I don't disagree with the. So I disagree with Bozy's character, in the sense that I think he's a selfish prick, but I don't disagree for the desire to want to live as he is without being persecuted or discriminated against. He's just not a good person, but that impulse I think is more than fair, right? Like, why should he have to hide? But he doesn't, with Bozy, it's because he considers himself superior, not because he thinks people deserve that, right? It comes from a different place. So that's why I'm having trouble reconciling it. But in terms of people having the freedom to live their life as they choose, I do believe that I think that's fair as long as you're not hurting somebody else, right? But then that comes with people like, oh, your depravity hurts me. How? Like, how does that affect your marriage? How does that affect your sexuality? How does that affect what you like? I mean, I don't know. So it is, it's a doozy. But I did, before we stopped, I wanted to touch upon Stephen Fry's performance, right? So Stephen Fry himself, openly gay, he considered Wilde, or I believe still considers Wilde, like a personal hero. And from my research, he poured his soul into the role. How does Stephen Fry's performance, and forgive me if this is a leading question, right? But how does it capture Wilde's wit and his vulnerability? Because you mentioned as well that you do see him more morose, you do see him more vulnerable throughout the film. How does his performance capture both that wit and that vulnerability?
Oh yeah, I mean, in some of his one-on-one scenes, you get to see the softer, sensitive side of him. When he's before any type of crowd of two or more, he's owning the room and he's lighting it up with his wit. But you are seeing a little bit, I mean, in particular, you know, a couple with Bozy when he gets swallowed, the one in the prison with his wife, you know, you're seeing a couple other sides of him. Whether or not Fry was out by the time he was doing it, did he go through a period of closetedness? I'm not sure.
Who?
The actor, Stephen Fry, too. Did he?
I'm not sure either. I assume that he would have.
It's interesting, too, because Jude Law has always been rumored to be gay.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he's played, I guess, Ripley, several gay characters that I'm not, you know, society has viewed him as such because of how well manicured he always comes across, and, you know, some of his, whereas he, he's been happily married with multiple children for years too.
Also had an issue when he was happily married to Sienna Miller and the nanny. I don't know if the nanny's his new wife.
Perhaps. But it's like, I wonder if, Fry and Wilde, not known for his visual, they're not described as a beautiful man or particularly handsome. it's his intellect that is attractive to all of his suitors, as most, it seems.
Yeah, no, and I do think there's definitely physical similarities between Wilde and and Stephen Fry. Wilde was also a tall, big man. When he had to confront the Marquis, or the Marquis, as the British called him, he broke his cane and stood up for himself and said, like, you want to try to thrash me? You can go ahead, right? Dispelling that stereotype of him as a ponce, right?
Right.
But I think what I, the way his performance affected me in terms of that wit and that vulnerability is, I believe he played Wilde as both a playwright and a performer of his own life. He always turned it on when he needed to or felt he needed to. So the scene that I'm thinking about is he, in the movie, it portrays him as obviously uncomfortable when Bosie wants to sleep with other men in front of him, because he just finds, it's not that he wouldn't sleep with Oscar, it's just like he needs to continuously be stimulated. And when Oscar gets to the room and people are trying to get under his skin, he just turns on the charm, turns on the performance, turns on the invulnerability until he wins the room over, but you can see him affected. So I see him as writing his life as well as performing his life. He created the way that the public Oscar Wilde I see as a character in a play that he created and he performs. But that more quiet, vulnerable Oscar that you see, actually, you actually see him with Constance, right? He's less, I mean, he jokes around, but there's quiet moments between them where he seems vulnerable and he seems insecure, where she reassures him. None more explicit than the prison discussion with them. Where she, it's funny, it's the wife that he cheated on who constantly accepts him.
Right. Well, she wants to keep the family together, or it's in, and there's a financial element to it, I think.
Yeah, but she won't denounce the name despite advice from people that it'll be better for her in society and financially.
Yeah.
As well.
Well, she doesn't think, because she's like, oh, your play's doing, you'll write another play. We'll still be able to have to live this life.
But I didn't see her as saying it, and maybe I need to watch it again, but I didn't think she was saying it in terms of like, oh, we need the money, you're just going to go produce. It was more like,
yeah,
you were doubting yourself. He's like, you'll write it. You can still do it. Like, you're still you, is the way that I took it. I may be seeing it differently.
But I viewed it as both. You're right. It could be interpreted either in that moment.
Again, I'm very partial to Ely's Elizabeth Bennet, so I might be biased in that sense. Right?
Can I turn that question on you just too? Like, you're sick of vulnerability. In what type of social situation do you find yourself most, your most authentic self? Or do you code switch often, is it one-on-one? Is it in a group of friends?
I think, I think whenever I'm connecting with someone, I feel my most authentic self. But I do know, for example, that like if this was a wrestling pay-per-view or PLE rewatch podcast, I'd be a completely different Renzo than I'm being right now. And it doesn't mean that it would be inauthentic. It would just be like, yo, did you see when we acknowledged our tribal chief and he fucked that guy up? Like it would be natural for that. I'm not speaking like this here. It doesn't mean that it's not me. I feel most authentic when I'm connecting. But I do think that even in that authenticity, I do code switch, because it's communication is distribution of information, and you're trying to be able to be understood, and you speak in the manner that you would be most understood in the medium you're speaking in. So I don't, like, I remember somebody was, I've been told that I can come off as intimidating or serious intimidating. Like, not that I'm intimidated, but like, I can be serious when you first meet me. And then you're like, man, you're so easygoing and funny and blah, blah. I'm like, I always was. I was just, you know, at a formal like gathering or event that was geared towards X. This is more that. It wasn't that I was pretending to be something else. It was just how I'm, where I'm at and how I acclimate to the surrounding. But I always feel authentic when I'm communicating. Or connected.
You know, great. I love that. But can you do that with in a situation with more than one person?
Yeah.
A crowd, yes, but like.
No, I think you're from what I understood is like maybe it's a group of like four people, each different. And I'm typically the social node that gets them to interact when they don't speak a common language. And it's because I'm able to speak each of their languages.
Right, right. Now that's also too. Yeah, you're bringing your authentic self to their kind of environment. And what, like the wrestling situation, like what's more special to you though, like you're broing out, you're having this, but a vulnerable moment creeps into even that, like that environment. That's the best when it yeah.
It doesn't creep in, right? Like it's just always there. So for example, I have certain friends who we are horrible to each other. We say the worst possible things about the things that like horrible things. I hope their moms forgive me for the things I've said over the years in terms of them and all that stuff. And then we'll be like, yeah, you can go blah, blah, beep, expletive deleted. And then like, okay, bro, love you. See you, talk to you later. Bye. And that is authentic. And we can have that moment when we're busting each other's balls and then life happens and we have to be real and we have the honest conversations and it could be like this very heartfelt conversation. Right. And then it'll be like, yeah, but you're still a piece of garbage though. Okay. Like it's interesting, but I'm using that example just to show that it applies. I think vulnerability is just interlaced when it's true and you feel comfortable. I think the vulnerability is just interlaced and you have dynamics of how you speak with people, of how you engage with people, how you interact, how you take connection from the moment. What about you?
Yeah. I mean, you know, for the most part, yes, when you are connecting with somebody, it oftentimes is one-on-one. But there's something sometimes when even in a one-on-one interaction, you're bending to them, they're bending to you, and you're trying to say something like it's missing the mark because you're both stepping almost outside of yourself. Maybe you're speaking a little bit, you know, in hushed tones, or you're not if I can't let my like goofball self out sometimes, you know, I don't feel like I'm being as authentic. But wit for me, as is, you know, like wild, like that, whether it's a safety mechanism, but that's when I feel comfortable, when I can just, you know, string a lot of language puns in any situation. But the benefit is that is like where you said you can be like the glue, like language for me, I'm able to maybe sometimes do that in various type of environments. But when it comes down to it though, to get to the core of a person, you know, I mean, it's hard to do that though in a group of people too. And the situation doesn't always, you know, I try to lean it towards that. Like, let's all like emote, you know, and do it. But that doesn't always happen in certain environments.
Yeah. But I mean,
and I'm not comfortable in those, I guess. I'm writing a little bit about my fraternity brother days too, where like I was actually in a fraternity, but I'm proud of rowdy people. For me, I don't function very well in a crowd. If I'm performing for, I love it, but I can't be one of the gang as easily sometimes. If I don't, yeah, maybe I guess I've been bent into it like a soccer game or something, but
I don't know. I mean, like, we have had heartfelt conversations as we're playing a game of horse, or like we're shooting a basketball and we're saying like Van Damme movie titles, you know, like it's
weaving in and out of it. Yeah.
It's still that authenticity. And I can understand the whole thing about being conscious about being part of a crowd. And I think what I live by is not everyone's going to like me. And I'm completely okay with that, but they can respect me because I'm going to be who I am, you know, no matter what. Like there are times when I like to throw, like I'm at work. It's a very serious situation. It's a very professional environment. And for my own amusement, I'm throwing out James Bond references just because I feel like it. And if somebody catches it, great. And if they don't catch it, fine. But I just, it's me. It's who I am. It's what I'm going to do. And if somebody has a problem with it, then they can talk to me about it. I don't know. It's just, I stopped caring about other people's ideas of how I should live my life a long time ago. Well,
yeah,
5 to 10 years ago, maybe not such a long time ago, but enough time that it's the norm now.
Well, I guess I'm speaking a little now because Oscar Wilde talked a lot about social dynamics too. It's like, I'd like to lead a conversation, but it's still to be a conversation. So like, if it's a crowd of people, please, let's all listen to each other. Okay. Let's actually hear what the other person is saying. Let's get everybody's opinion maybe on certain thing. Sometimes if there's sometimes one strong personality that is just not acknowledging everybody else, I clam up completely. But the selfish acts of me, like, I want to be like, all right, I'd love for us all to be talking about this same thing. So like, I'm set, you know, like, and who knows, am I guilty of bending it to my comfort zone? Maybe in the past a little bit more, but yeah, like I want one conversation, I guess, in a group setting.
And if people are playing word games, even better during the conversation.
Right. Well, then one conversation, then you can have the sub level of where there's something underneath it too. Yeah, where you're having a conversation, and then you're having a conversation under the conversation too. I don't know if I do that as much anymore, but that's funny too.
Mm.
Yeah. Comedy of manners. Oh, I'd like to write one of those.
You still can, my friend.
Yes. So,
final thoughts on Wilde?
Wilde, yeah. I'd rather see a movie version of one of his plays.
I've been wanting to see The Importance of Being Earnest.
Yeah, I think I've seen it before.
I mean, I've read the play, but I haven't seen
it. I've read the play. I've seen a performance of it too. I may have.
It's the one with Rupert Everett.
There's two versions. Oh, yeah. I think I loved it. Yeah, that's my review.
For me, great costumes. Definitely felt period. It felt of the period. I think the performances were really good. Again, just the fact of how much I disliked Bosie speaks to Jude Law's acting ability, I guess. Stephen Fry was amazing. I can watch, again, I buy audiobooks from the man so I can just hear him speak. I enjoy him. I think he's very intelligent, very funny, but I can see that, I can definitely tell the love that he put into his performance. As far as the movie, as it goes for real poets, I think it's a perfectly serviceable biography with really beautiful performances. But in terms of poetry, I don't see it advancing the conversation the way the other movies that we've seen have advanced the conversation in terms of how poetry plays in film, how that medium plays in film. So, but it had some fantastic scenes that, for example, the courtroom scene inspired my poem today, you know? So it is what it is. Thank you, Oscar Wilde. You were a wild man.
Wild. Be brave, be wild.
Do you want to read your piece, Scott?
Wildlife. Yeah, I was going to write my gay rights piece that I've written a while ago, because I haven't jotted down something immediately from this. I wanted to revisit that I had written this at a time of like the idea of, is a heterosexual male speaking out for gay rights in certain situations, can that be more helpful than actually a homosexual speaking out about gay rights? Because people are so turned off by wanting to hear from, like they don't even want to. But if they're, what are certain situations where an ally can be even more effective in people even listening to another point of view? Let me see. Where's my ad? Device. let me find it.
No worries. So it's just us, dear listener. What are your thoughts on Wild?
I'm glad I have a background because I'm currently wearing my cat boxers. Okay.
Meowza.
I want to give a quick shout out to, there is an Oscar Wilde themed bar in New York City that I have been to on a couple occasions. Oscar Wilde. There's a giant statue outside of it.
It has all the flowers inside.
Oh,
I've been to that bar many times.
I love it. I mean,
it's a great bar. I get invited. Fantastic. I just got invited to an event they were doing. I'm like, I'm here.
Because they had just opened up I don't know if they ran or they ever got any literary events like jumping off that were actually there. What was the event that you got invited to? Because it's like drink nights, but I didn't see any like literary events that they actually had.
No, it wasn't a literary event. I went there for brunch, loved it. And then every time I go to New York for some James Bond related activity, I think I mentioned James Bond like four times today in this play. But when I go to New York, it's normally like the anniversary of Live and Let Die, for example, or something, right? And my somebody who's now a good friend, he used to work for Turnbull and Asser. He doesn't work there anymore. My friend Dan. We tend to meet there. It's just a great, great little bar.
45 West 20.
It's not little. It's actually pretty goes pretty deep inside, but it's just a great atmosphere.
The dining, the bar area, dining area, 45 West 27th Street.
Yep.
The Wasker.
That's cool. I didn't know you frequented that bar. We frequented it at different times, which is cool.
Yeah, I mean, I worked near there for a while at a school, and just it was for someone that doesn't drink much or at all, I still love the atmosphere there.
I have they have a pretty good brunch.
Oh yeah. Yeah, had some good vittles there as well. So, all right,
I think Oscar would have liked it. Just
let's,
saying.
That. Let's see where this poem goes today.
Bring it.
Oh my God, that was so gay. Who, what, where, when, gay. Genetics mixed with environment. Stick same sex together with a psychological social fix and whether heredity alone hones a homosexual helix. Like Felix, cat's out of the bag. Is he or isn't he a flag? Waving in the wind if a mama's boy or has a daddy's thing. HOMOSEXUALS, take a guess. I used to say Will and Grace before every meal. Felt real cool watching Project Runway and The Wheel. When I think oranges and bananas have the same peel. Hell, I'd even let Sex and the City slide. I don't mind. So what? I got a queer eye for what's good in the TV programming guide. LESBIAN. When I tell you this, what then? I write poetry, wear bright colors, and played extensively with dolls when I was a kid. I make sure I match my eyes with my socks, yet strangely, I got a fraternity bid. Sigma Chi to the day I die, but I rarely drink, often overthink, and defy every single stereotype of a frat guy. I like dancing, don't mind shopping, and was in all my summer camp plays. Was one of the top athletes throughout my grade school days. Sticks and stones and names that never help. The only thing to queer is queer itself. Certain words and phrases faced by those in certain places is offensive. Perhaps because most homophobes are just being defensive. No matter how you slice it, fags aren't still slang for smokes. And the term for bundles bound of twigs and branches shouldn't be tossed in flames as jokes. If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. If you're gay and you know it, clap your hands. Most keep theirs folded. Do what they're told. Don't ask, don't tell till they're at least 20 years old. We're all homo sapiens. But without the sapiens results in insulting sexuals as such. To some, having more closet space proves to be far too much. They use their macho bravado of their straight peers as a crutch. Unable to come out, unsure of which sex is safe to touch. Wishing upon a Starsky and Hutch to pacify the fuss of which guy they now lust, because society tends to bust what they view as unjust. If only we could just get along. All men and women are created equal. And even though some are sweet and low and use sugar as a substitute for letting people know how splendid they truly are, every being stands to raise the straight, slanted, crooked, or gay bar. It was a woman that brought us all into this world, nurtured by nature, each linked to a girl. And whether raised by two males or two women, as long as every kid is loved like hell, they'll be winning all there is to win, grinning, apart from any religion that may or may not still consider this behavior sinning. Where every Native American, soldier, construction worker, cop, cowboy, and biker is singing, it's fun to stay at the YMCA. Gay people are people too, and there's no reason whatsoever to treat them any different from anyone treats you. I've been hit on by gay men, but I never hit on one myself. Blacks and blues and scars and scabs I have never felt. Like so many shepherds kept unheard, they were also beaten and bruised. Boys don't cry if they've got nothing to prove. He's no different from me, and she's no different from him. Anyone that kisses in public can be somewhat disconcerting, especially if you yourself complain, there's no one to hold me. But that's just because they got someone and you're lonely. Okay, so I am not gay. I'm straighter than a jacket, holding back whack loons from causing a racket, and I'm only attracted to women. But what if I called you up nights, like a homophobe does? How would you treat me if I had told you I was? All right. From the archives, where I had definitely performed that several times in like where before gay rights was even like a thing. But
how did that last line play when you performed it? What if I told you I was?
So there was some friends of mine that said, just say that you are, even though you're not, just to have the line land that, oh, I'm told you I'm not, but I actually am, you know, or something like that. Other times I'd have people coming up with, oh, wow, man, I really dug that. I mean, they like, you know, the double meaning on nights and nights, but in certain atmospheres, more like macho type of dudes would come up to me and be like, respect. Because they like, you know, I don't agree with everything in that, but good poem. And yeah, I mean, I got to see it kind of shift over time of
that
being more accepted. There was a line in a show that I used to say in a poem, you know, I'm gay. Actually, I'm not, but if I was, now would be a perfect time to let you all know this. I think I told you this. And like, when I said it at first, people would be like, what? Some people would be like, I'm gay. And then they'd shout out, I knew it. And that was always so like, whoa. And then I was like, actually, I'm not. But it was bad because then those kids felt bad about me almost like shaming them. Where like, so
didn't,
was,
didn't
it was
they
a weird,
shame themselves?
That they shame themselves, but also like, all right, you know, like, actually I'm not, you know, but then also when I'd said it, there would be gay people saying, oh, you can't adopt that and then take it back. But my whole idea was like, all right, yeah, you know, you could perceive that I am, but I'm going to tell you that, you know, and I'm, believe me that I'm not. Bo Burnham used to do that too, if you remember, you know,
yeah,
kind of the idea of playing with it. Anyway, I want to tackle that topic too. Like, do you think an ally can be more effective than the person that is to people's acceptance of it? Not in terms of encouraging and making it feel safe for other people to come out, but people's acceptance of somebody.
We can get into that a little bit. I think an ally is important because they're one of your first bridges that you can help cross, that you can cross. They can help put you in a position where you're listened to because they're using their equity to get you a platform. Right. So, you know, I get that. Like, it's, I get the debate, but I think that an ally serves a purpose. That's why they're an ally. So, comes to that.
Yeah, I guess you can't put it in levels, like it's better than, but like, you know, can that be deemed offensive to somebody who is gay by even like, you know, I'm being loose with language in that term, in that poem too, of like using words,
sure,
where like, you know, you couldn't do that, you know, racially. Possibly you could, but like sexual orientation wise, you know, I'm poking fun at it, but in any event, interesting little topic. So let's hear your wild inspired work of madness, of wickedness,
of want. So my piece is called The Price of Want Denied, and it is an ephrastic piece about Wilde in the style of Oscar Wilde. And, you know, I'm not trying to imitate here. I'm playing tribute. I'm trying to transcend. And I only say that not because I'm better. I say transcend because they stopped. They got to a point and I'm still here. I'm still alive and I can maybe push the boundaries a little bit farther because I have the benefit of seeing their scope of work, right? Everything that they've done.
Were you using a particular poem of his
What I did was I you know, he typically did couplets. he had simple rhyme schemes. He either did, you know, he either did ABAB or ABBA, right, in terms of rhyme. He typically used iambic, whether it was pentameter or tetrameter. And he tried to use lush language. He did epigraphs. He did all of these things. So I just kind of thought about how the things that he would write about and his style, and I just tried to emulate it to see where I could go with it. So this is The Price of Want Denied. The love that's found between a youth and one with years collected well has coined gold lies embossed with truth. For moonlit passions time will quell. The merchants trained to cloak their wares, proudly displayed yet veiled from view, arrange their clients' doomed affairs through covenants sweetly renewed. A bargain struck without return, no patron leaves here satisfied, yet connoisseurs alone discern the value of a want denied.
Mm-hmm. Value.
Yeah, I wanted to end with an epigraph, right? I wanted, yet connoisseurs alone discern the value of a want denied.
Now, it's in the style of Oscar Wilde. Are you putting this in a modern context, or it's kind of towing the line between, I mean, clients doomed? I mean,
so
merchants could be past, or it could still apply, I guess, to the present.
It can, and you know, I hesitate to go into too much of what I meant, but what I was playing around with here is the idea of, you see Wilde, like the two scenes we talked about, the prison discussion with his wife and the trial where the second scene in the trial where he's having a monologue, explaining himself, answering questions, I guess, but it kind of switches into a monologue. I think those are bookends, right, to his idealism and his cynicism, right? Cynicism being much closer to the Ballad of Reading Gaol, right, as opposed to his earlier works. And in that, I saw him as thinking, when he said, if I see Boji now, I'm going to kill him. I see him as seeing love as transactional, and Wilde loved to play with he loved to poke fun at, you know, well, if that's what's going to happen, let's use some language on merchants, let's use some language on that. And that's kind of what I was doing, but I was exploring the idea of having to buy what you want only to get what you don't, right? You give of yourself, and buy purchase with money, with other means, with yourself, with whatever. It's like, I find that to be, I find the irony of spending resources to achieve or obtain something only to get to a point where you've obtained it, but it's no good for you, right? And no matter how much you consume, you'll never be satisfied. No matter how much booze you could consume, he'd never be satisfied, right? No matter how much time Wilde spent with booze, he was never satisfied.
It's like a devil's bargain. I mean, but like a... with the devil, you're selling your soul for something.
I don't know if it's a devil, but I guess I could sum it up with
sinful, or is it a?
It's not even sin. It's more of a what you want, what you desire, your desires, whether they be good or bad. No moral quandaries on it. Nothing makes your desires more expensive, more valuable than having them denied. Is an idea I wanted to play with. Now, what went in there, there's much more to it, but it's that, that's kind of like seeing those two scenes bookending, being bookended, and then thinking about it in terms of the less you have of something you want, the more you want it, right? And then what happens if you get it? Would it be worth everything you put into it?
2 years of prison. Yeah. And meningitis.
You started seeing, like, when I was like, oh, come on. When he started, like, reaching for his ear as he was sitting up in prison, I'm like, man. Oh, come on. So obvious.
Oscar the Grouch.
Oscar the Grouch. But yeah, that's my poem. That's our poems. Scott, as always, I thoroughly enjoy discussing these with you. And
like looking wise forward to the next and, one, my friend. Likewise and witfully. I'd like to pivot maybe to see Slam, which will at least have the we were talking about, which has the prison, another prison parallel, at least. What poetry in prison.
We can see Slam next. Has that been decided? That was, I think that's the easiest we've decided on one.
It was been in the queue. I mean, it would be great to have the actual actor, Saul Williams, on it. But we can reach out to Bob. We can see.
Okay, so why don't we, let's put a pin on that one being next. Because if there's a possibility we can make that happen, let's try to make it happen. This has been Real Poets Discussing Wild. I'm Renzo del Castillo. As always, I am fortunate, blessed, hashtag blessed enough to have Scott Raven as my podcasting partner.
Down with PP.
And we'll see you guys next time. Peace out.
Pieces.
Reese's Pieces.
Real Poets is produced and hosted by Renzo del Castillo and Scott Raven. Original music composed by Gabby Weitzenfeld. Episode art and visuals by the Real Poets team. New episodes come out every other Thursday. Hit subscribe, download the episode, and leave a review to help us grow. This has been a Real Poets production. And remember to always keep it real.